Welcome to Move Well to Live Well, a podcast where we discuss all things health and wellness. I'm your host, Dr. Belle Moody, a physical therapist specializing in pelvic health. This podcast is here for you to help educate, motivate, and elevate your life. Let's get into it. Today's episode has a very special guest, Ms. Cassandra Palmer, who is a licensed professional counselor. We talk about lots of different things, her career as a counselor, how she began as a crisis therapist, her education. We've also defined trauma and how it affects us emotionally, physically. She talks about how you can recognize trauma manifestations in yourself and loved ones. And also, she goes through different things that you can do to help process trauma and move forward and live a more well life. Some of the things that we discuss in today's episode could be triggering to someone, so I encourage you to listen at your own discretion. I will tell you the overall conversation is extremely hopeful and positive, and I hope you enjoy it. Hello and welcome to the Move Well to Live Well podcast. My name is Belle. I'll be your host. Today, I'm so thrilled to have a guest with me. It is Cassandra Palmer, a licensed professional counselor, and we're going to break down different aspects of trauma and some other things in today's episode. So, Cassandra, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited.
Me too. I'd love if we could just hear a little bit more about you, anything that you'd like the listeners to know about you as we dive into trauma.
Sure. As you've already said, I'm a licensed professional counselor. I work with Starkville Counseling Associates in Starkville, Mississippi. I came to Starkville as a student and ended up getting my degrees in educational psychology and then community counseling, which is now kind of, it's called mental health counseling now. So I live in Starkville, have four children that keep me busy, and a husband and a dog and two cats. So that's a little bit about me.
That's great. So you said that you came to Starkville for school. Where were you? Did you grow up somewhere else or did you move here from out of state?
I graduated from New Albany, Mississippi.
Okay.
I was originally born in Mississippi, born in Tupelo and lived in a little town called Coffeyville, Mississippi. But my dad was a minister. And so we moved several times in my childhood. I started school. We moved when I was like four to St. Louis, Missouri, lived there, then lived in a southern Illinois, really small town again, not unlike Mississippi, very rural. And then my junior year of high school, we moved back to my dad's hometown of New Albany. So I kind of really didn't feel like I had a hometown, to be honest, until I came to Starkville in 1997. Met my husband, have been here ever since. So it's certainly home now, but I'm a Mississippi girl that lived a lot of her childhood other places and came back home.
So. That's awesome. Mm-hmm. So when you came to school at Mississippi State, was counseling, was that the direction that you knew you wanted to
That's a funny question. I'll give you the very short version. No, absolutely not. I almost went to the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs. I had three congressional nominations.
Wow.
And I came to Mississippi State my senior year. It's kind of like my backup sort of, you know, and came to, I think they used to call, well, it was an honors thing they invited me to and stayed and watched the football game with my family. And it was so warm and friendly and had a great engineering program, which is actually what I was interested in. I wanted to be a pilot, an astronaut, and an aerospace engineer. Very different.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So I came to Mississippi State for that and spent 2 years in engineering, even interned at a supercomputing center at an Air Force base between my freshman and sophomore year. Wow. And I kind of think that was a telling summer because the highlight of my summer was spending time with the family that I was living with and like with their kids. And I tell people there was this guy in the cubicle next to me, Well, my boss, the guy I worked with in the cubicle I was in, who oversaw my work, he wouldn't come in till really late, and he'd stay really late. So I'd have all these hours early on without him there, and didn't really understand what I was doing. And the guy in the cubicle next to me would ask me questions about it, or tell me about his kids, and I would help him problem solve. I was the oldest of five growing up, three of which were adopted and had other foster siblings. So I had a lot of experience with young kids and kids. And I didn't think I wanted children. Now I have four. Counseling was the last thing in my mind, you know? So,
wow.
But yeah, so eventually I realized sitting in a cubicle wasn't for me. And people think aerospace engineering, counseling, those are so different, but they're really not, because you use a lot of the same skills, you know, problem solving, analyzing. Everybody kept telling me my freshman year I should go into psychology because I was always listening to people and their problems. But I was really like, no, you can't get a job with a psychology degree. But eventually I gave in and realized, I held in until I got my first aerospace class, and I did not like it at all. And so I went to the career center. I had no idea what I wanted to do. So I did a personality test and interest test, and counselor, teacher, engineer, lawyer were like all on all my list. So wow. I thought I would be a school counselor and went into it with that in mind. But when I took my first, an undergraduate facilitative skills class, I was really good with the counseling piece, and I had learned more, and I decided, I didn't think school counselors get to do as much counseling as I really wanted to do. So yeah. I did that. But I'm also a really big, another important thing for people to know about myself is I'm a really big advocate for education and teachers, and mm-hmm. I serve on our local school board. So that's still very much a part of my life. Teachers in my life, I think, really helped me a lot. They helped me deal with some of the trauma I experienced in my life. And so mm-hmm. it all kind of goes full circle.
Wow. Yeah. Well, you certainly have a gift. And well,
thank you.
It was, it seems like it was obvious from, you know, from the, even at your internship. That is just awesome.
Yeah, thanks.
So once you got into, at Mississippi State, then you went into psychology.
Yeah, I actually did educational psychology, which has a big emphasis on like learning, childhood development, development across the lifespan. A lot of people that take like kinesiology, they do a lot of ed psych classes as well. So, because it kind of goes hand in hand sometimes. And I did that because I thought it was a little more practical. By that point, I had met my husband, knew I would want children one day, and thought that degree would be very helpful even just as a mom, you know?
Yeah.
And so I did that ed psych degree with an emphasis in counseling. You had to pick a concentration, and master's in that community counseling program, and also at Mississippi State, and both are in the College of Education.
That is awesome. I was in kinesiology, and I, as you say that, I'm thinking back to we had a lot of like different psychology mm-hmm. classes and development classes, and so interesting. The dates are very hard for me.
Uh-huh.
So like knowing at what time what happens, you know. So
I'm not great at that part either. Oh, I get the big picture, but the details, you know.
Yes. So then you started, after you graduated with your master's, is that when you went to work at mm-hmm. I'm sorry, what's the new
No, that's correct. Community counseling.
Okay.
I actually worked, my degree was in community counseling, now called mental health counseling, but I got my first job at community counseling in Starkville. I had done my practicum and internship with community counseling in West Point, had a lot of different experiences, feel very, very blessed by that. I worked with kids, adolescent offender programs. I worked mm-hmm. with a girls group home doing group. I had drug and alcohol counseling experience. I did day treatment in the schools, like with kids that have severe behavioral and emotional problems. So I got a lot of really great experiences. And I actually handled a crisis at the girls' group home. And so my supervisor, as a student, I was the least experienced, but I had the relationship with the client. So kind of talked her down out of a threat of suicide. And mm-hmm. I said, that's the day I earned my first job, because later I actually thought I wanted to work in the inpatient male drug and alcohol program they had here in Starkville. Mm-hmm. But the county administrator said, hey, I think you would be a great crisis counselor, and these are all the reasons why. And so I took that job. I really, really loved what I did. And I worked there a year and a half with children and families, anywhere mm-hmm. from typically 5 years old to 18. But I did see a couple 3-year-olds during that time. And wow. I worked the entire county of Oktibbeha County and saw everything. Kids that were at risk for removal from their homes or school, for whether that was onset of mental health issues, abuse of all types, if they had legal problems, behavior problems, I mean, you name it. And I learned a lot really hard and really fast and wow. kind of fell in love with it. I was thinking as we got ready for this podcast, you know, I didn't really set out to say, hey, I'm going to do trauma work, but eventually that's what I did a lot of. And mm-hmm. I guess that early work as a crisis therapist, you know, I was walking through things with clients while they were in the midst of the trauma as those events happen. And it's great if people can get help in the midst of it. It can prevent a lot, especially with young children. But sometimes that's not the case. So I guess my crisis work really is the beginning of working with trauma. I kind of knew I wanted to work with kids and families. Mm-hmm. And so that's how I got my start.
Wow.
Yeah.
So from the trauma standpoint, do you mind telling us, I guess, just a definition of what it is? Because I know when I started counseling when I was in PT school, I would mention some things and my counselor would be like, oh, well, this is this type of trauma. And I'd be like, no, it's not. In my head, sure. I'd be like, this was not a big deal, you know? And right. And she'd be like, no, it was. And so I think that can be helpful for people to know the overall definition.
What is trauma? Yeah, yes. That's a great mm-hmm. question. I think a lot of people ask that question. Trauma is an emotional response to an event in our life, or a traumatic event in our life. It can be what we consider, quote unquote, sort of big things, an accident, a natural disaster, you know, witnessing a traumatic event, war. Mm-hmm. I mean, lots of like really big things that we think of, but those really obvious things. And it can also be things that aren't as obvious, you know. And sometimes when people come into counseling, like you said, if we say that's trauma, people's response often really can be, well, no, that, you know, that's not trauma. Some trauma leads to PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, and some doesn't. And, you know, there's different ways of thinking about trauma, I guess, as far as types, which is kind of what you were alluding to earlier. Mm-hmm. There's acute, which is like more, you're actively in the middle of it, sort of onset, really severe, you know, kind of it's more obvious. Mm-hmm. And then there's the chronic trauma, where maybe people have been carrying these traumatic things in their life for a really long time, and it lasts and is pervasive in their life for a long, long time, you know. Mm-hmm. And then there's also complex trauma. And complex trauma, I think, is the one that people are becoming a little more aware of, mm-hmm. where it's not as obvious. It's not necessarily those big events. And it's often associated with childhood experiences. So maybe living in an emotionally or verbally abusive environment at times, or having a parent with a health issue or mental health issue. You know, you might carry things that you might not would, or take on beliefs that impact your life. And so we're learning a lot about that, or like attachment traumas and things that happen sort of more in the developmental process, when we're really, susceptible to that, if that makes sense.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, I'm learning.
Yeah.
I'm learning so much.
Well, one other thing, Belle, some people talk about big T trauma and little T trauma.
Yes, I've heard of that before. Yeah.
Yeah. And so big T trauma, I think when people are using that term, they are talking about those those more obvious things, you know, a soldier comes back from war, or a natural disaster, being a part of a tornado or a hurricane, or an assault, you know, or something like that. Those things that we typically think of as trauma, little t traumas, are those smaller things. And I'm hesitant to say smaller, and I'll say something else about that in just a second. But those things that aren't as obvious, they can be have just as much effect on our lives. So those childhood things, we all have traumas in our life. It depends on if we process them at the time that they happen as to whether we continue to carry the effects of those with us. So those little t, or those that are kind of that happen to all of us, or that were more chronic, to use the word I used earlier, chronic or complex. Those smaller t's, they're a little bit harder to define sometimes. But I was refreshing myself, thinking about this, and I found an article where someone said we shouldn't use that term, big T, little t, because it tends to minimize, it could have the potential to minimize those small t's. And those experiences are really real. So I want to be really clear to people that when you hear big T or little t, we're not saying that either is worse. Pain is pain. You know, you deal with people with pain all the time. And if they're hurting, they're hurting.
Yes.
And some people have numbed themselves to their pain. You know, I tend to be a person that can kind of ignore that. That's not necessarily good. Those things are there that we listen to them. And that's the same way for emotional pain. So just bear in mind, and to the listeners that are listening today, you know, big T, little t doesn't mean that one is more important or worse than the other.
That is so helpful. And I love the, I'm so sorry about my dogs in the background.
That's okay. They bring a little joy to the day.
my little Archie got a haircut yesterday, and he is feeling feisty ever since then. but I so appreciate the gentleness that you approach that with, and I think that can be super helpful. That was that exact term is what my former counselor would tell me, is, and that it was mainly in reference to the little t traumas for me, and that was where I was like, well, no, it's not. And and that's so,
I wanted to say that's not an uncommon response, and I think that's why it's so important to talk about that. Because one of the biggest reasons people maybe won't get help, or they'll continue to carry that, is because they don't recognize it, or say, well, my problem isn't as big as someone else's. Again, there's enough compassion to go around, and the human experience is that we can all have different experiences, but they lead to the same emotions. So that's really important, I think.
Absolutely. So with your work, guiding people through this and helping them process it and move forward, if people, I guess my question is, if they have unprocessed, is that the right, am I phrasing that the right way?
Yeah, I think that's a perfectly fine way to say it.
How do you see it usually manifest emotionally for someone, or physically, or both?
Yeah, well, there's definitely going to be manifestation in both ways, to be for sure. Initial warning signs of trauma can include things like feelings of exhaustion, confusion, can be anxiety and sadness. Can also be numbness, you know, like shutting down all the feelings, or on the opposite side of that, a heightened sense of awareness. Yeah, so being overly charged with emotions, or things being extra sensitive to certain stimuli and things. And these feelings, I want to be clear that those feelings are healthy and normal responses to abnormal events, you know. It's a part of the fight or flight aspect, you know. And depending on, a lot of people know a lot about fight or flight, but they often don't think about freeze. And freeze is another response to traumatic events. So depending on if the person is in a fight or flight response to their trauma or whether they're in a freeze response, you'll see different symptoms, because the fight or flight is more of an activation, whereas the freeze is more that withdrawal and pulling away and or paralyzation, not wanting to, you know, be triggered and that sort of thing. So those are just some like basic things to kind of start the conversation. Those emotional symptoms, at first, it depends on where you are in the process. You know, if you're actively in the middle of the traumatic event or you're further down across time. But initially, there might be shock, denial, and disbelief. I think I mentioned confusion, but it could also be difficulty concentrating, anger, irritability, mood swings, anxiety and fear, guilt, shame, and self-blame. Withdrawing from others, feeling sad or hopeless, or feeling disconnected and numb. Those are some other like emotional and psychological symptoms. Now, does everybody experience all of those? Not necessarily. Can those things be caused? We all experience some of those sometimes, right? So it's kind of looking at the pervasiveness across time. Usually with trauma, there is that denial of, that I don't have that, or minimizing it, not wanting to address it because there's a lot of fear because it's been so overwhelming. So that happens. So a lot of times people won't come in on the emotional side of it. They begin to come in to get help. And I bet that you see this in your work all the time. People do begin to come when they have those physical traits, because I think if we don't take care of the emotional side, it carries out in our physical being. And really, the more and more I'm learning about all of these things, I don't even think that it's always manifested in the body. It's just the longer we hold it and take, you know, the longer we ignore it. Just if we ignored, you know, if we broke our ankle, we wouldn't ignore that. But if we did, it would get worse and worse and begin to affect us in other parts of our body.
Yes, 100%. So I have a question. As you're talking about like the different types of manifestations, but then also the fight, flight, or freeze.
Right.
Do you see like with different, maybe I guess personality type is the word I'm looking for, like with different types of people with certain, and I don't know if that's, I don't want to like stereotype people, but I guess the more type A, maybe, do you see certain manifestations with different types of personalities, or is it totally can vary?
Sure. I think that's a really interesting question, actually. I appreciate you asking it. I think yeah, that maybe different personalities are gonna you know, maybe your type A people, they've already, my thought would be they've already developed like coping mechanisms where they tend to be fighters by nature, you know, maybe. And so they may go more that route. And people who maybe don't have those personalities, or they, you know, again, maybe their life experiences or family of origin or things, a lot of, I think, fight or flight, working with couples, it's usually you have a couple, one's the fighter and one's the fleer. Sometimes it'll swap, but a lot of times it has to do with how they saw conflict being handled. And I think that kind of feeds into how we deal with traumatic responses. So I think, you know, it's not only personality, but experiences. And technically, from a science side, people that study this would say that in the moment with fight or flight, your amygdala and other parts of, you know, the brain and such, it does a quick survey to see what is your greatest chance for survival. Is it fighting in this situation or is it fleeing? And then sometimes it's freezing. And we as humans can kind of make those, we unknowingly maybe say that fighting is better and like fleeing is secondary and then freezing is the worst. But it's truly is a physiological response that we don't have control over.
Wow.
So, I mean, it might play out in personality, but technically it's a survival mechanism, and they're all equally good because they help us survive. And so, you know, sometimes I have clients because they froze. One of the emotional things that, and I mentioned this symptom earlier, they carry a lot of shame or guilt because they feel like they didn't fight. And so a lot of the work I do with them is saying, no, that's natural. That's your body. You didn't have control over that. There were a lot of reasons why, and helping them to learn to have compassion towards that. So I think that's a really great question that leads into a lot of interesting thoughts, you know?
Wow, and I didn't know that about the it's so primitive, and I bet that helps people knowing that, like you're saying, once they know that there was so little control over it, really helps them move forward.
There's an analogy too that it's in a book called Burnout about how, and has a great illustration. I heard it somewhere else the other day. You know, if a lion chases a gazelle, that gazelle, and he catches him and chomps on him, the gazelle will fall down and play dead so that the lion will leave to go and you know, get the other lions to come feast. And the gazelle, so it froze, it paused, and it didn't process that traumatic event of being bit, right? And so while the lion's gone, it's going to get up and go away, like flee. But before it can actually flee, it begins to shake all over, processing that traumatic event of the bite. And so I think for people, especially my clients that had a freeze response, they start having these moments where they get overwhelmed by certain triggers and they're literally shaking. They can become tearful. They can, you know, be really scared. And it's very overwhelming and kind of scary for them. But when they come in and I help them to realize it's okay to be with that, you ignored it, you pushed it aside. We all do that. We have a bad day, you know, something at work or, you know, what have you. And something really upsets us, we don't usually break down and cry right there, but we have to kind of keep it together for various reasons. But if we go home and we don't process it, that's kind of what burnout is about. That's that kind of chronic buildup of those smaller T traumas, you know, these little those things. And sometimes I think in our culture, we think we just have to push through or ignore. So that's the danger of that kind of message that might come in certain people, certain personalities, certain cultures. Tell me if I'm getting too much. I get excited
No,
about
that I
sharing
am
these
just
things.
this is great. And I have another question for you.
Sure, what is
So
it?
if you've experienced this event, whether it be the like you're saying a bad day at work or if it's a major event that's happened that's caused that emotional response, how is the best way to I guess process what's happening to move forward after that.
Sure, yeah. And that book Burnout talks about this as well. But let's talk about like the daily kind of things, and then we'll talk about the bigger things, I guess. It's pretty similar, but I think there's a couple of distinctions. But just like that gazelle, you need to process it. So if they're these smaller daily things, and we kind of think we do great by pushing it aside or whatever, it will accumulate, and our bodies will begin to break down on us. So the book, there's some ways that we can process it. One of those is movement, you know, getting out and exercising. A lot of people think, oh, exercise. But if you think about it as being kind to yourself and helping yourself, because what happens is the brain is flooded with a lot of hormones and chemicals in that fight, flight, freeze activation. And when it's these smaller, quote unquote, things. Sometimes our body activates in a fight or flight when we're not really in a life-threatening situation. Because remember, this is primal that went back to the days where we're hunting and, you know, gathering and all those kinds of things, right? So sometimes if our body's highly activated and we don't have the opportunity to actually fight off a wild dog or, an animal or something. Our body is in this state of overstimulation. And that's when people have that overstimulation response. We didn't really talk about the emotional responses, but I mean, the physical responses, but it can be like the things like panic attacks, heart racing, muscle tension, aches and pains, being startled easily, difficulty sleeping, fatigue. I mean, I could go on, but those are, some of the more obvious ones that can build up even in these smaller daily type of things that happen. So getting out and exercising to kind of release some of those chemicals and work that out is really good because trauma really does start in the body. And then the other thing can be to talk it out with somebody. Another thing can be to like just go home and let yourself finally have that emotional response, like the gazelle, that Shay's. You may feel like you still need to cry. Our tears are chemically different, whether they're happy, angry, sad, or afraid tears. Yes. Isn't that amazing? I love to tell people.
No way.
Yes. So there's a different chemical release that happens. And a lot of people, they don't want to cry because they're embarrassed or they've gotten the message that I have to be strong. I mean, people come in and cry with me all the time and they apologize. I'm like, why are you crying? That's why I'm here, but we feel this kind of message that we don't need to cry, but it's actually really good. So having that, allowing yourself, yes, we put that on pause, but just like the gazelle, we've got to come back to it. So exercise, having the phys the that emotional response like crying, or sometimes there's a lot of energy or angry, like getting that out. I think exercise can help with that. Talking to somebody. Also, another interesting one that was mentioned in the burnout book is doing something creative with what you're feeling. So a creative process is another way of processing, whether that's doing art. It just kind of takes us into our body, takes us into the creative aspects. I mean, I'm sure things like dance and movement in general as well is really good. So those are some ways that on a daily basis we can make sure, that we're taking care of ourselves. People with traumatic responses, something to maybe mention is they're at a higher risk for drug and alcohol addictions too, to cope with these things. So a lot of times we start turning to other things to cope. So I think it's really this question you've asked about what are some of the positive ways we can cope with traumas is really important. And so to the bigger T traumas, or the more acute, or if there's this major life thing, anytime you can get some help and support in the midst of going through that thing, it's very helpful. Especially I saw with children, if I could be there with them during the trauma and they could process some of that, they're very resilient. They create new pathways. Because what happens in trauma is we develop beliefs about ourselves, especially as children. We blame ourselves. We think it's our fault. And we carry those or we have shame or guilt. And we carry that sometimes for 20, 30, 40 years. A lot of people, it comes to head for them midlife if they haven't dealt with those things. So, I saw children who have these really bad things. And one that I remember was a young child who saw his dad shot. And I honestly, I didn't know what to do for him. He could barely talk. He was 3 years old, and but he was having manifestations. In children, you'll see a lot of different manifestations, but you might see regression, and he was having nightmares and regression. And we played. The presence of someone else being there with someone when they're going through something really bad, can often be very healing. So to any parents that are listening, certain signs of trauma that you can get on the internet and read about in children, not all of those things always indicate trauma. Some parents ask me that, like, this is going on with my child. Did something bad happen? Not necessarily, you kind of have to look at the picture as a whole. And sometimes kids don't need, I mean, they certainly sometimes really need counseling, but they really just need the presence of somebody. And that's really what we're all looking for as humans. And so if you get that early in the response, it can often be very helpful in healing. Because a lot of people that have traumatic responses, they turn inward and withdraw. And then they feel very isolated and lonely. So with kids or anybody, if you can give them some help early on, that can help. But that doesn't mean it might not pop up later in their life at a certain developmental stage. There might be some new trigger or something like that. But the best thing for someone to do if they think they might be dealing with this is to talk to somebody, you know, to get help. But all the things I named earlier for those daily things, those are great things to do in the meantime, too, or along with, you know, focus on your body and being well and getting safe, connecting with people again.
Wow, I have more questions for you.
Okay,
this is such good stuff.
All right.
So, on the note of the presence of someone in the midst of trauma and in those chronic situations, I'm sure. Like, also, let me pause and say this: I am a huge, huge, huge believer in counseling. I wish that every single person could go from a preventative standpoint.
Me too.
It is so great. And it's so eye-opening about yourself and how to, it is so helpful. I just wish everybody could do it. And so my question is, having the presence of someone else and talking to someone else, I personally think this is important, but I want to hear your opinion on it, is the, like, seeking out someone who is a professional counselor like yourself, over relying super heavily on close friends, having a non-biased support system, like a counselor, I feel like is really important. Because sure, when your conversations with people, they're not, they're probably not always easy. Some of the things you have to say to kind of lead people to self-realization about certain things, it's probably not always in their favor, you know, when oftentimes if they're talking with friends or family.
Are you saying they might not like what we have to say sometimes?
Yes.
Yes, that's true.
Yes. So true. My question is, how important do you think that is to...
Great question. I think it's really important. There's a place for both. Okay.
Yes.
You know, but you nailed it. Our friends, they're going to tell us sometimes what we want to hear, not what we need to hear. Also, our friends, there's so many reasons it's great to have an unbiased, you know, person and a trained person. I mean, some of these things, you know, I mean, I have a few people that I've worked with that just hearing our podcast today, hearing the word trauma, they're so severely traumatized. The word itself is like triggering to them, right? So there are things, I mean, you know, that we're trained in how to help someone through. And sometimes our friends, they want to help, but they're at a loss. They don't know what to do. And they can begin to feel overwhelmed. And then when someone's, had a trauma and they start to feel people pull away. That was actually one of the signs I was reading about, kind of, again, refreshing myself. What are things that I might not remember or think of, you know, is like you beginning to withdraw or others are beginning to withdraw from you, you know, because it can be too much sometimes.
Wow.
And they carry it on a different emotional level when you share. I'm not saying don't share with your friends. You can, but having that professional that knows the things we're talking about and can guide you, or if it, especially for people with really actively triggered trauma, it may come up and it can be super overwhelming for them. And then that leads people, I think that's why sometimes people are afraid to get help, because they felt that distance from a friend. Or the truth is, in our relationships with friends, our significant others, husbands, wives, children, when we love people, we still disappoint them and let them down. And when you talk about people with maybe that complex trauma, there's a lot of fear of like abandonment and things like that. And nobody can be available 24/7, not even therapists. But we're able to more easily set those things aside and keep a very, you know, boundaried and relationship that helps people to kind of heal through that, I guess. I don't know if that made much sense the last
yes,
part.
Yes, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah. You want somebody that can, you know, handle it and know what to do. And that doesn't mean, but I think it's both. And you need people in your corner, friends and family, that are going to encourage you in your therapy, that can listen in the moment and just get angry with you or whatever. But it may not, that's not always your therapist's job, you know. Your therapist's job is to help you work with what's inside you and to get better. So you want people in your life that are going to be there, because we all need, you know, all those aspects.
Wow.
Yeah.
I have two other questions.
Okay.
So the first one is, or maybe this is more just a comment about mm-hmm. when you mentioned with friends and family, sometimes it can be overwhelmed and they carry that with them.
Mm-hmm.
But then people like yourself and even me work with patients, it can be pretty heavy sometimes, the things that are shared, and but there I have been guided in ways to keep that from affecting me physically to where mm-hmm. I don't carry it with me in that heavy way. And so I feel like the same for you, and you and I have kind of discussed this before, but what are some of the things that you do yourself to protect from that overwhelm throughout the days of working with people?
Yeah. I mean, I think the very first thing that I do is recognize what my role is mm-hmm. and what I have control over and what I don't. You know, I learned really early on. I mean, I think I came into this career because I had carried a lot in my life. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of easy for me. I can just keep packing it on. Like, and that's dangerous. I have to watch out for that. But mm-hmm. I learned early on in counseling, okay, I can only help this person. And I really believed in like my presence in that moment, the power that's there, and a lot of their life circumstances. Working in that crisis job, I mean, I didn't have control over
mm-hmm.
half, most of the things. So I think that was really good. And I tell new therapists, if you take on everybody's burdens, you will not last in this field.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I learned pretty easily, maybe even am just like naturally, like it's a natural talent to be able to separate from that some.
Mm-hmm.
But self-care is super important. So I have great coworkers that we staff our cases once a week and to get ideas, to get help, but also it's to take care of ourselves. How is this building up in us? And, you know, during the pandemic, it got really hard for mental health workers and medical workers, because there was just so much need. And we were processing our own experience of this, you know, craziness mm-hmm. in the world too. And so having support like that from other colleagues, but for me, I know when it's building up, because I'm not enjoying my work as much. I love what I do. So if I'm starting to dread it a little, it's like, that's a sign. I need friends in my life that notice if I'm withdrawing, or like I have a friend after the pandemic, I'm just like, I'm not really wanting to go do anything, you know?
Yeah.
And she said, that's not like you. And I'm she kind of stuck with me. So friends can be the person that can tell you that thing you need to hear too, you know? Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay. And I went and talked to my healthcare provider, and I'm like, okay, I'm having a little bit of a tough time. I get therapy.
Mm-hmm.
You said you're a proponent of therapy. So am I. I would never see a therapist who hasn't been a client. Because I believe in that for many reasons. One, we can only take our clients mm-hmm. or patients as far as we've gone ourselves. So I have to keep growing and keep learning. And that holds me accountable the most. When I hit a wall with somebody, or when I, you know, sometimes I'm going to diverge here, but I'll bring it back, I promise. one reason people struggle in their own being with other people when they're hurting is because it brings up the hurting within them.
Mm.
And they haven't dealt with it.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're afraid to be with other people's pain. They want to fix it instead.
Wow.
But if there's a great Pema Chodron quote that I'm not going to be able to quote off the top of my head. But the relation, oh man, this is going to drive me crazy. It talks about the relationship between a healer. It's not between a healer and the wounded. It's sitting with them in the dark, essentially, is what she said. Mm-hmm. To know someone else's pain, we have to have known our own. And it's worded much more eloquently than I just did. Maybe I'll send it to you and you can post it somewhere, but it's really beautiful. It's that idea that we have to be okay with our own emotions to be with them with others. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's why having therapists and care providers that are willing to look at themselves and grow. So I do therapy. I at times in my life am more active than others. And again, mm-hmm. when it starts creeping up on me and I'm feeling really bad, I know I need to get outside. I need to get moving, mm-hmm. Or find time in stillness. Those are three things that I've learned to be more in tune through the years. That's been a long journey, but in different ways, but being more in tune to my body and inviting that in. And I think, again, I've bumped into that because I want to help clients that are struggling in that. And I can only take them as far as I've gone myself. So,
wow.
Yeah. And doing fun stuff. Like, life is serious. I get too serious sometimes. So, you know, I have to remind myself just to go do something fun.
Yes.
Find that balance.
That is, oh my gosh, what perspective.
Well, thanks.
And, you know, even with PT, when I went to do my pelvic health course, you have to have all the exams done on yourself, you know, and mm-hmm. the main thing is that, like, if you haven't had that experience, then it's so much harder for you to relate and you know, and understand where your patients are coming from.
Yep.
And it helps you to be more respectful, more sympathetic, more all of the things, having been there yourself and been with it. So,
Awesome. I'm glad they do that.
Yes. And there are, like, there's some ways, this is terrible, but there's, like, some ways you can get out of it if you don't want to, you know, but that's the thing, is you're just hindering yourself. You're hindering your ability to be a better provider.
I feel like we have to model what we want from our clients and patients, right?
100%. Yes. Mm-hmm. I had another question. I wrote it down and then so it's kind of going back to when you said through, like, the daily basis and the more chronic, like, things that happen throughout the day, like the bad day at work, and then the different recommendations of how to process that on a regular mm-hmm. basis. And my question is, I have heard this before. I haven't, like, haven't looked at the actual studies behind this or anything, but I have heard that with, like, things that, like you mentioned, creative and dancing and even just walking, like, physically mm-hmm. exercise and all, creates bilateral stimulation of the brain, which is really helpful in processing and unrooting negative emotions. Is that
yes
true?
That is true. Okay. I wouldn't have known the right words to say all of that, but yes, that's absolutely right. That's you know, I think when you think about just getting, like you said, bilateral processes of the brain, mm-hmm. the right and the left. I mean, I was doing a movement practice I'm training in EFT, which is also known as tapping. That's a new thing I've started doing to try to help some clients that they're really getting stuck in their bodies. And this can be a useful tool if you're, you know, adequately trained in it. Mm-hmm. There's, like, a basic process and then there's a more evolved, and I'm new at this. I'm just learning about it. But one of the things in my training this week that we learned was there was this part where you hum. And then you count out loud and then you hum again. And the humming was to activate, I think, the right side. I get sometimes the right and left, like, which one does which. But
oh,
I think the
gosh,
right is like
too.
The creative and the mat. And then the left is the more logical. I think I could have that backwards. Don't anybody, like, be too upset with me over that. But the point is, the humming activated one side, then the counting would activate the other. And by going back to the humming, you're bringing it back the other direction. I thought that was really fascinating, you know? So, wow. And in teachers in school, they talk a lot about whole child learning, and they can learn by doing motions, and, you know, they try to activate the whole brain. There's a lot we're learning about brain research and neuropathways, and to be honest, trauma stuck in a rut in our brain in the neuropathways. You know, we've walked this path, we've believed these things over and over and over through our life, a misconception, playing for something in childhood, or that it was my fault, or, you know, and we've believed that, and it creates, I tell people, it's like my dog makes a rut in my yard where he runs to see us when we pull up, you know, he didn't take the sidewalk, right?
Yes.
And so he's going to go that way every time. But by processing traumas, and we're learning a lot of those creative or body pieces, really release some of that in the brain and offer the opportunity for new pathways. And so your therapist and then yourself, and having compassion towards those parts. You know, I tell people, my dog will follow me on the path if I take him a different way. So I use that analogy of that's what we're doing in therapy. Okay. We're leading you on a new path. And it's not going to feel easy at first, because it's, you know, it's new, like a new exercise feels uncomfortable. But the more you do it, your body kind of develops this body memory. And there's a lot about the brain and neuroplasticity that we're learning, and people much smarter than me, you know, talk about all the details of that, but it's fascinating stuff.
Wow.
Oh, did that answer your question?
Yes, that was so good. So if someone, I have, someone told me one time when they were struggling with, depression, that they felt like they were down in like a, I guess a well would be a good way to describe it. Like they were down in the bottom of the well, and they could see everybody else doing all of these things. And, but they just felt like they couldn't get up there. There was just no way they would ever get back up there with everybody else and experience and things like that. So if, and that's a whole nother topic itself, the depression, but, say someone is really stuck, because of past traumas, because of ongoing traumas, and they've listened to this episode, they realize that activity is would be really helpful, but they just feel like they can't get up to it, I guess, or can't, like, is there anything that you would say, or even it can be multiple things that you would recommend that kind of will help spur out of that stuckness, I guess?
Sure.
Terrible word, but
I think a couple things is recognizing that is a great first step, and that it's okay to need help. Sometimes that might be needing to share that with that friend for the accountability, so that they can say, hey, what did you do today? Or how can I help you today? Or have you called that counselor? Or, you know, like take that first step. But what happens a lot of times when we're that low, we tend to keep beating ourselves up and putting ourselves back in there. We'll take a step forward, and then we tell ourselves it's not enough. And so I think being kind, and that's hard for people that have had some of these experiences. That's why they need help in therapy, is with that. But just, you know, if you can't, just start with a little, lean into it. Whether that's movement, or, you know, or take that first step to call and get help. And, but be kind to yourself in those things, you know, do start with, I always start with base level things, you know, movement, eating, you know, those kind of things. And don't tell yourself you have to do it all. You know, you got to this place little by little over time. It's going to be the same way getting out of it. And it'll come quicker than you think if you allow yourself that time and trust the process of that. But also tell somebody, ask for some help. Tell somebody, hey, I think I need to go do this, or make that appointment. Like, you know, I've had to do that at times. Years ago when my back was hurting, I made an appointment with, well, I ended up in the ER one night, and then later on it was hurting again. I went to a chiropractor. By the day I went to the chiropractor, I'm like, I'm okay. But I went ahead and went, you know. Or, uh-huh. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times, I know that's what I was going to say. That first step, if we accept it, it becomes, in behavioral terms, what we call, like, it starts the momentum going.
Yeah.
You know, and so that mm-hmm. it can become a snowball of, okay, I did this, now I'm going to do this. You know, I make that appointment with the physical therapist or whoever, and I look at my body, and then, oh, that's coming up. I realize maybe why I didn't want to go look at this is because there's some emotional things connected. Mm-hmm. Okay, mm-hmm. now I need to be kind to myself and make a little more room, you know, to do something else. And it kind of becomes a snowball process. I don't know if that was the best answer, but
that was so great.
Something, yes. I've got.
Well, and I think that's super encouraging too. And I think back to when I had been to a psychologist when I was younger, and then I went years without seeing a mental health professional until I was in PT school. And really, it had been kind of years building up of different things that I was struggling with. And it just got to the point where, like, as soon as I made that appointment with my counselor, it was amazing how much better I felt just by doing that. I was, and that really, like you're saying, I think yeah. back on it now, and I'm like, I remember feeling that momentum, and I, you know, and how much, even just by calling, even by yeah. just calling their office.
A like, lot of I people feel that they know that, okay, I'm going to have some help, and that it's okay to have help. You mentioned like previous experiences with mental health providers.
Mm-hmm.
That made me think of another barrier that sometimes exists is maybe people had a not so great experience for some reason, yes. whether they were a child or whether it was forced on them, or, I mean, you know, there can be a lot of reasons. Don't be afraid to give it another chance and tell your care provider, hey, I had a not so great experience and this is why, and they'll have better mm-hmm. understanding of how to meet you. Had a counseling professor that says counselors are like used cars. You got to try them out and see what fits. Certain personalities are going to mesh. A lot of people, you know, good counselors can work with a lot of different types of people, but then sometimes, you know, we all have different preferences for doctors and different things. And
yeah.
And we have different experiences in our life. Maybe at that point in our life, we were more resistant in some way, or our therapist was going through a bad year. I mean, you know, yeah. there could be a thousand reasons why it wasn't a good fit or a good time, but be willing to go back to that. Because especially pre, like, your early 20s versus mm-hmm. afterwards, your brain development shifts so much. So even if you've had counseling at a young age, doing it later,
yes,
opens up like a new process in it. So
yes. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, that is such good info. Today I have learned so much.
Well, I'm so glad.
From hey, you.
There was one more thing I wanted to share, because it's been sitting here, because originally I think you asked me to talk some about how this affects pain. So I did want to make a plug
yes.
for that, is that uh-huh. people who've experienced childhood trauma or suffer from PTSD are mm-hmm. 10 times more likely to experience due wow. to the mind-body connection. In other words, mental and emotional pain can manifest as physical pain. And then I had another, so apparently there's maybe an estimated 1 in 5 adults suffering with chronic pain.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, chronic pain is reported in 20-80%. That's a very wide range of individuals with a history of trauma. And 10-50% of individuals with PTSD and report chronic pain. So I don't know. The numbers were kind of broad, but it definitely, our mind and body are very connected. And so pay attention to your body. Pay attention to those feelings.
Yes. Gosh, yeah. That is so telling. Those mm-hmm. Statistics. With the work that I do, I haven't necessarily sought out to for this to be one of my focuses, but it's become one of my favorite things to treat people for, which is chronic pain. And I there was a class that we had in PT school where we really talked about it a lot. It was not one of our like major courses, so to say. So I feel like a lot of my classmates didn't take it very seriously, but I was locked in. I was so fascinated at the, because we went over a lot of chronic pain science and the new things that have come out. And I know from just at some of our discussions, like the things that you do are so similar, the way that you help people regulate their nervous system, make those new pathways, calm down those that are in that, like the hyper reactive to everything, like bring that down some. It is amazing what that can do for the physical body. And sometimes that's the primary problem. And
you've taught me a lot. I feel like that's an area it's one of those areas I'm having to grow to keep up in, because we do see it so much and I didn't really learn that. So it's something I keep learning. You've taught me a lot as well in that. So it's kind of cool how our worlds connect.
Yes, and I think they just complement so well with one another. And there's a book I've read a little bit. It's pretty dense, so I've had a hard time.
I better know which one you're gonna say.
Is it the Body Keeps the Score?
Yes, yeah. I haven't finished it either, but I've actually heard the author at two conferences with the internal family systems model that I use. God, and he's really dense. Like, to hear him speak in a lecture. Yes. Oh my goodness. If you can get a fifth of it, you've gained a wealth of knowledge. But he also has a very thick accent, so it's really hard, like your brain to stay so focused. But he doesn't read as I'm listening to the book in audio form, actually. And he's not the narrator, thankfully. I can understand it well, but it's a great book. It's helping people understand how their body holds all that trauma.
Gosh, it's so eye-opening. Even the like first chapter, I just couldn't believe the connections that he made working with people, and how he saw that, just how it manifests in the body. They are not, mind and body are not operating separate from one another.
No, we treat them that way, but that isn't the way it works.
Yes,
as much as we try.
So, oh, such good stuff.
Thank you, Sandra. Yes,
thank you so much. I'm telling you, I have learned just a ton today.
I'm so glad. Sometimes when you do this stuff all the time, I think, well, what do I have to share? You know, but that makes me feel good that it helps you to learn some things. And it's always a pleasure to just make connections and talk about things, learn from each other. So thank you for this opportunity.
Oh my gosh. Well, I'm so appreciative. And let me tell you that I know I've taken away a lot from today. And I get what you're saying. It's like when you share these things so often with people, because it's what you do, you know, it's your career, it can feel like not as major. But I know that the people that listen to this and then share it with other people, this will be so beneficial.
Well, that's my hope.
Eye-opening to and hopeful, most of anything, I think, to know that. I think even just in the way that you speak and the of your voice feels very hopeful. Like, there's so many things that people can be doing, and even in the midst of such traumatic events and experiences. So I'm so grateful for your knowledge and you taking the time to do this.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. That's very honoring. I appreciate it.
Of course.
Thank you for listening. Please subscribe, rate, and leave us a review. You can meet us and work out with us in person at the Studio Bar and Wellness located in Starkville and Lewisville, Mississippi, or move with us online at www.thestudiobarandwellness.com on StudioStream. Our goal is that you move well to live well.